really want to cook for Mother's Day, so she's going to do that. All right. Well, I can tell you this. The first time I went out and did a ministry trip, electronics were not allowed either. There were no electronics.
Did you leave your slide rule at home?
Well, I can remember, some of you are old enough to remember, when the first personal electronics came out. It was a Hewlett-Packard scientific calculator.
73, I think.
Yeah, it was 73 when it first came out. And I was just starting my stint at Caltech then, and one of the professors showed us this amazing instrument that could actually do statistical calculations. And we looked at what it said. We all got to get one. He said, "Well, it's $500."
Yeah.
And that was 8% of my salary, annual salary. But it's like we had to have one. I mean, trying to do all the statistics by hand was just too onerous. So we all went out and got one. And it came in this full-grain leather holster. So you could always pick up the Caltechers because they had a holster on their belt which had their Hewlett-Packard calculator in it, which you can now buy at Walmart that's got far more power than what we had back in 73 for $8. So, but that was the first personal electronics. So, and yeah, we wouldn't be caught without one. Everywhere we went, we had it. So I can understand why young people today would see the lack of personal electronics as a tragedy beyond all description. So, my sons can't believe I actually lived in a day when there were no personal electronics. They said, "Well, Dad, that must have been hundreds of years ago." And I said, "No, not quite that long ago in the past." So, but we're in Proverbs 30. I'm going to be moving into Ecclesiastes, then into the book of Isaiah. We go through the Bible, studying all the creation texts that exist there. But for several weeks, I've been promising I'd give you some of the new discoveries. And these are just discoveries that were published literally within the last 5 days that pertain to our study. And one was published in Nature a couple of days ago. And they've actually found for the first time isotope evidence that biological nitrogen fixation dated previously to 3.2 billion years. And that's a big change because we thought that nitrogen fixation did not take place until well after what's called the Great Oxygenation Event. And I've got a slide that shows you the Great Oxygenation Event, but it'll probably take me about 5 minutes to find it. So I'll just describe it for you. When we look at the history of the Earth, it's always had oxygen. But at the very early history of the Earth, the oxygen content was below 1/1000th of what it is today. Atmospheric oxygen was about 0.1% of what we have today. Now, that was enough to prevent naturalistic prebiotic chemistry, which is one reason why we know the origin of life is a supernatural event. The early Earth had too much oxygen in its atmosphere. You know, say 1/1000th doesn't sound like much. Even the tiniest amount of oxygen prevents the production of the nucleobases and the amino acids and the assembly of these things to make proteins and DNA and RNA. So it's 1/1000th, and it stays that way until 2.4 billion years ago. So for the first 1.2 billion years of life history on Earth, the oxygen was less than 1/1000th of what it is right now. And then 2.4 billion years ago, it jumped up to about 2 or 3% of where it is now. And they say, "Well, what is it now?" It's about 21% oxygen in the atmosphere by volume. So it went up to 3% of that, which means it's roughly 1% of the oxygen content. That's called the Great Oxygenation Event. And thereafter, you had enough oxygen to sustain nitrogen fixation. What they now realize is nitrogen fixation actually far predates the Great Oxygenation Event. Now, what's significant about nitrogen fixation is that certain nitrogen minerals are crucial for making possible an abundance of life. And so the thinking was there really wasn't that much life on planet Earth because there wasn't adequate nitrogen fixation going on. I mean, for example, if you've got one of these lawns that looks really brown and you're watering it all the time and it still looks brown, That's because it doesn't have the nitrogen minerals it needs. So you go to the hardware store and buy one of these nitrogen fertilizer bags, and literally within 2 days, your lawn goes from brown to green. So that gives you just an idea how important these nitrogen minerals are to facilitate the growth of these different organisms. But now they've found that it literally does date back earlier than 3.2 billion years. It may in fact go all the way back to the origin of life itself. Now that means two things. It means you've got organisms that have the biomolecular complexity that they can actually generate the metabolic reactions that make these nitrogen minerals. In fact, what was astounding to them is the isotope evidence demonstrates that it's molybdenum nitrogenase mechanism that's at work. You say, what's that? I won't go into the details, but it's the most complex but also the most efficient way life can take nitrogen out of the atmosphere and turn it into nitrogen minerals that facilitates the growth of all these organisms. So the most complex of all the nitrogen fixation chemical pathways evidently was there certainly previous to 3.2 billion years and may have even gone back all the way to the origin of life itself. Now, what they did not put in the paper is that this is heavily dependent on molybdenum. And the molybdenum is a rare earth, but when it comes to planet Earth, the crust of planet Earth has got 5 times the quantity of molybdenum of what we'd expect in any other rocky planet. Our planet is super molybdenum rich. And because of the richness of that molybdenum, it'd be possible for a creator to make these species, these unicellular species of life that can actually make these nitrogen minerals through the molybdenum nitrogenase metabolic or chemical pathway. So, how this ties into our lesson, Isaiah 45, 18. Let me read it to you. God is speaking, he's talking about life, and he says, for this is what the Lord says, he who created the heavens, he is God. He who fashioned and made the earth, he founded it. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. He says, I am the Lord, and there is no other. I have not spoken in secret. So it's really making a point here, and this is consistent with what you see in Psalm 104, how God not only created life on planet Earth, he created it in great abundance and great diversity. He said, I created it to be filled. And what you see in Psalm 104, no matter where you go on planet Earth, you find life. I mean, you can actually drill through miles of ice in Antarctica, and there's bacteria underneath all that ice. So, you know, you go to the highest mountains, the deepest oceans, life is everywhere. You can, and it's because God filled the earth with life. And I would say this paper published in Nature is simply more evidence that God designed the chemistry and the physics of our planet and created its first life so that indeed life could be super abundant on the face of the earth so that we human beings, after 3.8 billion years, can have this enormous treasure chest of biodeposits. And without the nitrogen fixation mechanism, we simply wouldn't have the store of biodeposits we have here in the face of the earth. So that was a couple of days ago. Another one that, you know, how many of you ever heard of the global warming controversy? Okay.
The what?
The what, yeah. Okay. Well, I addressed that in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, making the point when you look at Job 37, 38, and 39, it makes the point that, number one, we human beings are the master of this planet. God put us in charge of this planet, and we're to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. And that comes right out of Genesis 1. That's how Genesis 1 ends, where God says to Adam and Eve, you're to manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit of yourselves and of all life, but he doesn't tell them how. And as I've mentioned here in the class, we've got good textual evidence that the content of the book of Job predates that of Genesis by many hundreds of years. And so Moses could get by with a one-sentence summary because the people already had a 3-chapter-long creation care handbook. That's kind of what Job 37, 38, and 39 are all about. But the point that we made in the book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, is that God designed our planet and its life in such a way that we face, quote, environmental crises and how we can manage the planet for the benefit of all life in advance, he provided us with solutions that are optimally economic and optimally ethical. And the reason why all of you have heard about global warming is that it's a political battle. One side says we have to sacrifice our well-being, our wealth, and our economy in order to make sure the planet doesn't get too warm. The other side is saying it won't work to sacrifice our economy. We can't enforce it, and we're not going to be able to make it work, and we're not so sure that global warming is even real in the first place, so we're not going to do it. And so there's this big political battle going on. But the appeal that you see in the book of Job is God has given us solutions that will make for better human well-being, greater wealth, greater technology, and will help, quote, stabilize the climate. Now, one big proviso on this, and I've mentioned this before in the class, climate stability is not a given. In the history of the Earth, we've only had extreme climate stability for the last 9,000 years. And as I've mentioned in this class, no matter what we do as human beings, the very best we can do is stave it off for maybe another 1,500 years. Because of the Milankovitch cycles, the fact that the Earth's orbits tilt and its orbital shape are varying with respect to time, it's simply a matter of time before we undergo climate instability. Matter of fact, what might bring it on fastest is what's called the precession of our planet. I say, what's that? Well, our planet rotates once every 24-hour days, but it precesses once every 22,000 years. Kind of like the, okay, remember those kids' toys? And again, this is only going to work for those of you who are old, okay, because they don't have these toys anymore. But those of you who are older will remember when they had these little toys that they'd give the kids at Christmas time where you pull a string and this top would spin very rapidly. But what entertained the children was the fact that not only would it spin very rapidly, it would precess. You would see the tilt of the spinning top slowly precess as it spins very fast. Turns out all rotating bodies do that. And so there's a precession that the Earth goes through, and which is why the North Star right now is a very good North Star. But I can tell you, when I was a young child, it wasn't as good as it is right now. Our North Star became the best North Star around about 1997. And now it's starting to drift away from pointing towards north. And if you wait 13,000 years, the star Vega will be the North Star. That's all due to the precession of the Earth's orbit. But how that can impact our climate? Right now, because of the precession, we are closest to the sun in the wintertime. Northern Hemisphere wintertime, we're closest to the sun. In fact, this past year, we made our closest contact to the sun on July 3rd. Now, how that benefits us and stabilizes our climate, it means that those of us who live in the Northern Hemisphere wind up having warmer winters than we otherwise would and cooler summers. So it actually makes for a more even climate. So what about those living in the Southern Hemisphere? It goes the opposite way. Their winters are more severe and their summers, or winters are colder and their summers are hotter. However, the impact doesn't really kick in until you're at high latitudes. Well, again, visualize the globe, and I got a slide for this, but it'll take me forever to find it, so I'm not going to put it up here for you. But look at a globe, and what you notice is the continents are oriented in such a way that there's lots of land mass at high northern latitudes. Think of Canada and Russia. They cover a lot of land area, and they're at high northern latitudes, and a lot of people live there. Now, look at the southern hemisphere, and it's the other way around. Almost all the land mass in the southern hemisphere hugs the equator. There's not much at high latitudes. The only land masses you find at high latitudes are at Antarctica and the very southern tip of South America. But notice how much land area you have at the southern tip. If you drop below 40 degrees south latitude, there's hardly any land area. I mean, you basically have got a tiny piece of South America and you got Antarctica and that's it. So because of that, and because of the time in which we live, we have this extraordinary climate stability. It also has a lot to do with the physics of the sun. The sun entered exceptional climate stability literally 50,000 years ago. Yes?
What's the difference between the closest we are to the sun and the furthest? Is it just a few percentage points? How much difference does it actually make in temperature?
It's about 2% difference. So it does make a difference in temperature. But yeah, what this all means is in a few more thousand years, it's not going to be July 3rd. It's going to start moving into September and October, which means that we who live in the northern hemisphere are going to be experiencing colder winters and warmer summers. And that's going to destabilize our climate instability, as will the change in the eccentricity of our orbit. And it looks like the two are actually going to line up. And so that could drop us into an ice age fairly quickly. And whenever you're in an ice age, you've got extreme climate instability. Hey, but back to the paper. This is a research paper published in the journal Science and talks about second growth forests. And the thinking was, you know, in terms of global warming, you really don't want to cut down the old growth forests because the old growth forests sequester huge amounts of carbon. That's true. I mean, if you've got a tree that's 8 feet in diameter, it's going to have a lot more carbon stored in it than a tree that's 1 foot in diameter. And, you know, that means a lot of carbon gets pulled out of the atmosphere to make that gigantic tree. But there is a study done in the jungles of Brazil, so tropical jungles, and they looked at Brazil and a few other tropical forests, and they noted that there are these forests that are being cut down and turned into farms and pastures. And of course there's a lot less carbon that is sequestered in grasses than there would be in a forest. But they said because of the low nutrient in the soils of the Amazon, that's true. The Amazon region, the soil is very poor. And so when people cut down the trees and try to turn into farmland, they discover it's not very economical. And so what happens? They abandon the land, and the land reforestates. And so they looked at the second growth, but what they discovered was something that they didn't expect, that the rate of removal of carbon from the atmosphere for the second growth forests compared to the rate of removal from the old growth forests is as much as a factor of 20 times. So basically it's saying this green movement idea that we need to put a stop to the lumbering industry, it actually is the other way around. We need to encourage the lumbering industry. And actually the paper ends by saying if we lumber the right way, which means you cut down trees in such a way that you can replant the forest and basically replant in such a way that you get a much more efficient drawdown of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to make the wood, you can get this factor of 20. If you don't do it the right way, you only get like a factor of 5 or a factor of 10. But it said we can actually structure our lumbering industry to get that maximum factor of a 20. And moreover, they said that's where you make the most money in lumbering. So here's another example where if you do it the right way, you make more money, you boost the economy because now you've got this lumber industry going on. The point they made is this. The lumber you harvest is sequestered carbon. So it's actually a good idea with these old growth forests, take that down, turn it into lumber structures, and then replant the area so it sucks up more carbon. And the bottom line is this could be another way that it won't resolve the global warming, but it would be a factor that would help. Yes?
I'm kind of confused there. You started off saying these big old growth trees sequester a whole lot more carbon than the new ones. Now you're saying that new trees are much more efficient at sequestering?
Okay, the difference is this. An old growth forest will sequester about twice as much carbon as a second growth forest, just because the trees are a lot bigger. But the fact is, with an old growth forest, you wind up with a lot of dead wood. And that dead wood decays and puts carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. And although an old growth forest stores twice as much carbon, the rate at which it removes carbon from the atmosphere can be as much as a factor of 20 times less. because it's basically a somewhat stagnant forest. You're not seeing any growth in the amount of wood that is sequestered. It's basically stable. Whereas with a second growth forest, you have this aggressive growth of new trees, and it's that aggressive growth. So it's the rate that's a factor of 20, not the amount of carbon. The amount of carbon is actually only half in a second growth forest that it would be in an old growth forest. But the whole point is, it's not a good idea to have these old trees die and decay. You're better off harvesting them and replanting them with new trees. And that's what they meant by wise lumbering. There's a right time to go into an old growth forest and harvest the wood. You want to harvest the wood before you get a lot of wood dying and decaying. And the other thing is, you don't want to remove all the trees. It's important, at least for some species of trees, that you leave a few of the old trees around, because it actually makes for a more efficient growth of the new trees. So that's kind of what the paper was saying. Lumbering done the wrong way may only give you a factor of 4 improvement in the rate of carbon removal, but if you do it the right way, you can get it almost, you'll get up to a factor of 20. And also, in terms of the lumbering, you make more money. You get a better quality lumber, you make more money, and so they're basically saying this idea that the lumbering industry is bad for the climate and bad for the ecology, it's actually the other way around. Lumbering can be good. And matter of fact, where we live, lumbering can be good because we got a water problem. There's not enough water falling from the sky, and when trees don't get enough water, what happens? The bark beetles take over and kill the trees. Now, one way you can stop those bark beetles, you harvest the lumber. If you thin the trees out, then the trees actually have more water per tree, and that's, if a tree has enough water, it can fight off the bark beetles. But if it doesn't have enough water, and so one of the problems here in the Los Angeles area, we've allowed the trees to get too dense, hence the bark beetles take over and they kill the trees. And rather than letting the trees be killed, we'd be better off lumbering them where the trees would be at a healthy level. And you would do that by making sure the lumbering is consistent with the rainfall. In dry years, you want to lumber more than less. And by the way, it's not just unique to us. It's a problem all over North America and Siberia. There's not enough lumbering going on to keep in check the bark beetles. Yes.
Sounds like a good argument for cutting down all the coast redwoods and starting over then.
Well, the point of the paper is you don't want to cut down all of old growth because, for example, with the redwoods, they provide a barrier to capture moisture. I mean, if you actually go up into Northern California, the amount of fog that these redwoods capture actually provides extra rain. So, for example, that area gets like 30 to 35 inches of rain a year, but because of the redwoods, it's like you're in an area that gets 50 to 60 inches of rain because of how those redwoods capture the water. So again, just back to what it says in Psalm. We need to be, Job, we need to be wise about how we manage it. And, you know, one way to do it is by experiments. And people have done that. Oh, we cut down too many of these trees. We need to do it this way instead of that way. And that was kind of the point of this paper. Lumbering can be bad if it's done the wrong way. Lumbering can be very beneficial to our ecology if it's done the right way. And if you do it the right way, it's actually more economic. You get a better quality timber, and people actually make more money. Yes, Ted.
I was going to comment. A few years ago, maybe 15 years ago, we had horrible fires through Yellowstone and other areas that were contributed to by super dense old wood that just was accumulating and accumulating with no lumbering or immediately putting out the fires. Then when they started, they took hundreds of square miles. So. And that was wood that mankind could have used.
It is, but there's also a delicate ecological balance there. If you lumber in such a way that there are no forest or grass fires, the soil does not get the charcoal that it needs to be healthy. And so it's important that we have a measured level of fires taking place. And if you over-lumber, then that's not going to happen. And so too much lumbering can be a problem, too little lumbering can be a problem. But God has called us to be wise in the management of these resources. We need to study this. By the way, is the reason why science is a good thing. We're to study nature so that we can fulfill God's command to wisely manage the resources for the benefit of all life. You're next.
When I was growing up, I think a common folk wisdom was that the United States was far less forested than it was when the Pilgrims showed up. But then I remember reading an article a few years ago that actually the inverse is true. Because of all the cities planting trees and the amount of, well, you wouldn't know it by Ohio because there's a lot of farms there and they used to be all forest, but actually by acreage, there are more forests in North America now at this point in U.S. history than there were when the Pilgrims showed up.
That's true. I mean, look at the Los Angeles Basin. This basin had very few trees before we built the city. But we imported water, and so the import of that water, we've been able to have trees all over the L.A. Basin. And so the reason why the U.S. has greater forest coverage is because of we have managed water distribution. Without that, we wouldn't have more forests. And also, you know, I think we're wiser in how we manage the forest than before people were around to take care of it. And bottom line is, I'm glad God created trees. Because of the way He created trees, we can have nice furniture in our homes. We can actually have homes built out of wood instead of steel. And, you know, it made possible the launch of, I mean, just think about it. Could we have launched civilization if it were not for trees? And then I met a missionary once who spent many years in Saudi Arabia. And he said, where I was ministering in Saudi Arabia, there were no trees at all. And he says, it actually affects your psyche. If you live in an area where there's no shade and no trees, it changes the way you feel. It actually changes the emotional state. And he said, I remember living there in Saudi Arabia and how when people had a weekend where they could get away, they headed for the nearest forest. Even though it was hundreds of miles away, they'd all head for the nearest forest just because they wanted to have that experience of being a place where there's trees. And so we can kind of take that for granted. I mean, most of us have never lived without trees being around us, which is another reason why I don't think people are going to last very long on Mars. I mean, if you go to Mars, there's no trees there. And, you know, it's going to get pretty depressing. Take the trees away, people get depressed. So, yes. Correct. 1% Well, I mean, those figures you're quoting are not much different from what I was saying. I mean, if you actually measure the precise amount of oxygen in our atmosphere today at sea level, it's about 21% of the total by volume. Nitrogen makes up about 78.5%. Argon makes up nearly 1%. The reason why there's so much argon in our atmosphere, it's the radiometric decay product from potassium. Potassium 40 decays into argon 40. So it's one other reason why we know the Earth is fairly old, because of all the argon we see. By the way, the Moon has a very slight argon atmosphere. And so it's not totally atmosphere-free. It's got a little bit of argon, and we can actually see how the argon on the Moon's atmosphere has eroded its craters over billions of years. So Mercury has quite a bit more argon than the Moon.
So my other question then is, all of this pollution that we are causing as humans, does that become part of the composition of the trace gases?
Okay, human activity is pumping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Our animals are pumping more methane into the atmosphere. That's the main human contribution. We're also putting a number of chloride compounds into the atmosphere, but those are very, very tiny. On the other hand, they can be quite devastating on the ozone and the stratosphere because there's not a lot of atmosphere there. And those chloride compounds can be destructive. That's one reason why there was a law passed to prevent it. So notice that your air conditioning in your cars doesn't work as well as it did 30 years ago. That's because, what was the chemical?
Freon.
Yeah, Freon has now been banned. And so we're using other things to cool our cars instead of Freon, which takes a little more gasoline to burn to make that all happen. So, but it's because Freon can escape and go into the stratosphere. Now, it's not a lot of Freon, but it only takes a very tiny amount to do a lot of damage. So human activity is the only measurable impact it has on the atmospheric composition of any significance is ammonia and methane. So, and, you know, as the temperature warms, you're going to pump a little more water vapor into the atmosphere, too. And by the way, of all the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, water vapor has the biggest impact. But it's also the one that changes the least. So it's the amount of extra you're pumping in. But yeah, the carbon dioxide level, even now, is only 0.4% of the total. So it's not a big contributor, but it has a big impact. Okay.
Notice that obviously the book, talking about global warming, there are, being an engineer, there are lots of low-cost techniques to cool the planet. There is no low cost to warm the planet. But for those, my friends are obviously all worried about global warming, the 2% warming in the summer, there are lots of low-cost technologies that the U.S. has enough money to implement to cool the planet. Cooling is never a problem. Heating is always a problem because that's energy. But cooling to say shade.
Right.
Or reflection.
Shade or reflection. Right.
Very low technology.
Yeah. So we do have solutions that can help. Some of the solutions are a little more radical than others, but I wouldn't recommend. Like we can put a whole bunch of reflective flakes in the 200 miles up above the Earth, and that would block out the light of the sun. The problem with that is, what if the planet were to significantly cool? It'd be a lot harder to take all that stuff out of the atmosphere.
I differ with you on that. It's satellites that would unfold 50% shade, and if it doesn't work, if you need it, they roll back in.
Yeah, they can do that. But there was a plan that's cheaper, where they just throw flakes up.
Yes.
The problem is collecting the flakes isn't easy to do.
That's cheaper, but not because it's not reversible.
Cheaper because it's not reversible, right?
You want reversible in case you make mistakes.
You want reversible. And yeah, that kind of technology, you're actually putting up these reflective shades. You could actually control the climate that way. That's actually been proposed as a way to try to maintain the climate. But bottom line, I can tell you, the real issue is not the temperature of the planet. It's the variability of the temperature. And so some of these solutions are going to be challenged to try to keep things from going unstable. And yeah, you'll see some articles I've written about that, how rather than trying to maintain the temperature, the real challenge is, what can we do to keep the climate stable? So you could have the same mean temperature of the planet, but if we have climate instability going on all over the place, that's going to have a dramatic impact on our agriculture. So. Okay, I got more discoveries, but I've eaten up a lot of time. Let's actually try to jump into our text here. So, Proverbs. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And for 3 weeks now, I've been trying to get several of you to kind of give some stories of a way of a man with a maiden. I'm going to give up on that. I'm not getting very far with that one. But the main theological point I was driving there is that, you know, this text is saying, here are three amazing things we see with animals that are very challenging for us to understand unless God is directly involved. Now, I read that passage in Isaiah 45:18. Let me just jump back to it, where it says, He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. He says, I am the Lord, and there is no other. I have not spoken in secret. Basically making a point, we can look at the natural realm and recognize God did this. And God is basically saying, this is not hard for you to discover. I didn't do this in secret. I did it out in the open. And it was clear that I am the one that did it, nothing else did it. And kind of in today's creation evolution thing, it's like, hey, it's not creation or evolution that did it. It's clear that I, the creator, did it. There is no other alternate explanation. for the fact that this planet is so filled with life, so such a diverse life, and has been here so long. So that's Isaiah. I'm really the only answer to this. What we see here in Proverbs 30 is it's making the point that how do you explain what the eagle is able to do or the snake is able to do from a naturalistic perspective? You know, clearly this is something that's indicating the handiwork of God. And as we go through Psalm 30, it's basically giving you several examples where it says three things we really can't understand unless God is the one behind it. And then the last one is always about human beings. And it's where it says the way of a man with a maiden. We talked about last time how when you look at the higher animals, they have a courtship that they go through. But it's typically brief and relatively simple. With humans, it's long and complex. I know of a married couple where their courtship lasted 20 years before they got married. Two Christians, they were in business together, and finally they said, you know, maybe there's something romantic that's going on between us after 20 years of working side by side in the office. And as far as I know, that's about the longest courtship I've ever heard of. They're very happily married. And they have a wonderful ministry together. They had a wonderful ministry together before they got married, before they even started dating. But yeah, it was a 20-year courtship. And for most human beings, where you've got a stable, successful marriage, it's rare that the courtship is less than a year. And you don't see that in any of the animals. It's unique to us human beings. What's also unique to us human beings is the courtship isn't just two individuals. I mean, if you look at the birds and the mammals, the way they court one another, it's like it's just the male and the female. But with humans, it's different. The courtship involves extended families and even extended communities that work together to bring about this married couple and the family that results from that. That's kind of the point of the text here, is that as amazing as it is to try to explain these courtship rituals we see with the animals. And I didn't really get into this in any detail, but there's been a number. We talked about some papers that have been published and how the people who published this research on the courtships, they're mystified as to how this could have evolved. Because these courtship rituals literally pop up out of nowhere, but they're there. But with humans, we see something orders of magnitude more complex. And yeah, I tried to drag some stories out of you about your courtship complexities. I'm not getting anywhere. I'm going to let that go. Probably it's because you're aware this is recorded and several hundred people will actually hear about your story. So, by the way, one of the dreams I have is that we'd be able to live stream this class because literally hundreds of people listen to this class, but they'd love it if they could participate live and ask questions live. So, well, we'll see if we can ever get the technology to make that happen. It's not that challenging. But yeah, I'm going to move on to the next one, but I do see a hand here, Ted.
Yes, I have a quick comment. You're a very brilliant fellow, and you can figure out me or the other men in this class in 5 minutes. But after 40 years or however long you've been married, you still haven't figured out Kathy.
That's true.
There's a mystery about the females that we males can't fathom. That's part of the courtship, is a mystery. And the ladies, a lady can look at another lady, talk for 5 minutes and know what she's up to. But they look at you or me or any man in this class, and what the heck is going on?
Well, they know what we're all about.
Right. So I think that's what Solomon was saying. This is a mysterious, wonderful thing, and your wife affects your very soul every day, right? One off-color comment or one loving look or touch, and you're off in la-la land. You think it's just the greatest thing in the world, and it is. It's the greatest gift next to God. The greatest thing in the world is the opposite sex.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Song of Solomon, Ted, because I figured, hey, I'm not getting anywhere with trying to get stories out of the class, but there's a great story in Scripture. It's the Song of Solomon, which basically describes the courtship between a man and a woman. And it's got theological overtones, that's clear, with respect to how God relates to us. You know, there you can see the complexity of courtship between a man and a woman. And also notice in the Song of Solomon, the community is involved. It's not just the man and the woman. The community is deeply involved. And I think that's something we need to get back to. Courtships used to be longer and more complex than they are today. mainly because today we've seen a breakdown in the community. Because, you know, in the old days, the families were very involved. And one story I told you is that when I first started dating Kathy, I wound up having a dinner for her parents where she was not there. And that kind of was a bit surprising for them. But that's the way I was raised. When you date a woman, the first thing you do is you get to know the family, and you want to get to know the family without, quote, your date being there. And that was a way to try to get the families together. So, but that's hardly done anymore. I mean, we have these great rituals that go back hundreds of years, thousands of years, and we've lost sight of it. And that's where I think the Song of Solomon can be really valuable to try to teach us. There's a reason why. And it's not just a man and a woman coming together, it's families coming together, communities coming together, and this is why it's complex and needs to take some time. Yes?
At age 37, I was not married. I had gone through life and had lots of male friends, dated a lot, and nobody ever seemed to be what I needed or wanted. And I saw so many bad marriages, I didn't want any of those. And so my aunt sat down with me at Christmas one year and said, "Don't you want to get married?" I said, "Sure." She goes, "Okay, well, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go find where the kind of guys you want to meet are hanging out, and you're going to hang out there. But you don't hang out with the girls. You don't talk to them. You sit there next to somebody that looks nice. Introduce yourself. Don't invite them home. And get to know them. And, you know, you will probably find somebody." So I thought about it. I came out here and thought, well, I've got a horse, I got the stables, nobody there. Go to church, there's nobody even my age there that's single. And finally I thought, I'll go to another church. So I church hopped a couple over the course of a few months. And I ended up here because God sent a girl that needed to meet with me, and this was a medium place where we knew. And so we went to the singles group back then, Koinonia, and I... They announced a funny little video that Friday, and I went to it, Milo and Otis. It was at your house. And that night there were 12 men of the right age, and they all had jobs. And there were 5 women, and she was engaged, so that was easy. And so I met my husband that night, but it took us 8 months of hanging out, doing all the youth group things, and after 8 months he invited me to ride with him up to a Koinonia camp out up in the mountains, and we had 4 hours of talking and front and back, and he grilled me on every question I could ever imagine, and he finally said, eventually, after 8 months, and then some more months, he said, "Why don't we look at, you know, getting married?" And I said, whoa. So he says, "I don't like marriage like it is. I have my own house. I can pay my bills. I can take care of myself. I don't need you." And I said, "What I do need is companionship and somebody to do life with." And so he came along and said, "Well, then let's try to redefine that. What can that look like?" And we spent the next 8 months redefining it. And I finally said yes, and so,
very good.
We've been in this church.
All right. All right. We got someone to share. Fantastic. But I also like what Ted said, is that no matter how long you're married, you're never going to totally figure out your spouse. We human beings are extraordinarily complex. And one reason why you want a long courtship is to make sure that that's going to work out. But I can tell you, I've been married almost 38 years. And I'm never bored with Kathy. There's still things I'm trying to learn about her. So thank you, Ted. That is true. No matter how much time we men and women spend with one another, we're never going to figure each other out. And that's part of the joy of being married. But hey, when you do in your courtship, you want to explore the differences. So often what happens in courtship, people explore the similarities and not the differences. And those differences, well, as you know, that's what makes it exciting. You were next. Yeah.
Well, let me share something a little different, I guess, since I just had some sharing about a personal example. By the way, what I was going to say is this is the first time I heard you say that meeting with Cassie's parents was without her presence. I thought that was with her presence.
Oh, no. That's kind of the Canadian thing is. You, You want to do the, you know, get to know the parents without your date being there.
But I haven't shared my own story because it sounds so different from what you're talking about in the natural ritual thing. That in my case, I was gone through most of my 20s, not having any interest in marriage at all, just being independent. It wasn't that I wanted a wild time or anything like that. Just I like the idea of independence. I met my wife at a party one night. I saw her sitting across the room. She saw me sitting across the room. We fell in love instantly. I worked the next year trying to struggle with this idea about not wanting to be married. We got married, and 40 years later, we're still married.
Great. All right.
So, very different from what you're talking about in here.
Well, I think that's part of the beauty. Each of us has got a different courtship story. It's not the same. You look at the animals. You know, pick a particular species of birds that's got a complex courtship ritual they go through. It's the same. With us humans, it's different. Yes.
Back to Ted's point, my wife knows my condition far sooner and far better than I know my own. At any time.
Well, that's one reason why married couples tend to live longer than people who are not married, because the spouse can actually see things that you can't see. They can tell. And, you know, a couple that's been married a long time, they know typically when the other one is depressed or happy or joyful before they know it. And, again, that's part of the joy of being married is you have that. But, again, that's why I think the courtship needs to be complex and long. So, okay, there's another hand. Yes.
Oh, he pointed to me?
He pointed to you, yeah.
our process was 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years. Not quite to the 20, but
no.
10. All right. Paul, you got to give some details now. 10 years. Why did it take 10 years?
I don't know.
Okay. You don't know.
Okay, so we met in a logic class, and we had this funny little, we were both shy, and so that's why it probably, you know, we barely talked. So that's probably why it took a little while on the onset. And then...
Now, I wouldn't think that a logic class is the typical way people meet.
No, that's why it took 10 years.
That's why it took 10 years.
I remember walking into the class on the first day and seeing her, and something picked in my heart. That person, I think, like, you know, you see girls in college all the time, but I saw her and I thought, there's something about her, but I wasn't a Christian that year, and so I didn't take those inputs into my heart that I know now when God gives me, God's giving me kind of instruction when certain things pop into my heart, but I didn't. But she and I got the top grades in the class, and we found it easy to talk to each other because we're both kind of found it easy to think logically, and we were kind of chatmates. We'd see each other. We saw each other a lot in that class, and then after community college, we both ended up going to the same four-year university.
Ran into him on the first day.
Right.
Didn't know he was even going to transfer there. I guess the conversation was never headed that way. Saw him there, thought, oh, there's that nice person. And so that was kind of good. We chit-chatted. We were friends and just kind of became friends that saw each other once in a while. But I guess my senior year, he... my last chance.
Better do something.
But the funny thing is, he wasn't a Christian yet, and I was simply because I was. I mean, he's nice, but you know, I knew what was important about being equally yoked. So we did go out, but then when he asked me again, I thought I better tell him that Christ is just the most important part of my life. He's like integral. Without him, I'm not even saved. It's not the whole thing. And he was really receptive of that, and he started going to our church, and he became a Christian.
Actually, the way she put it was, she asked me if I thought that Jesus was a real person. And I said, yeah. I said, well, do you think he was the Son of God? And, you know, I was raised as, my family were disaffected Catholics, and they walked away from the church when I was small. So all I remembered was seeing communion and saying, what are they putting on that guy's mouth? You know, and it was just really kind of disconnected for all the theology of Catholicism. My parents didn't talk about it. My dad was in the National Geographic, so it was kind of a secular humanism was the household philosophy. And she asked me, well, if you think God is real and you think that he can relate relate to you personally. What do you think he wants to be in relationship with you? Do you think that God wants to hold you in personal relationship, not just at a distance? And that was a really provocational question. And I had had so many Christian friends as a young man, you know, high school through college. I had friends who went to Lake Avenue and all kinds of things. They never gave me an invite to go to church. So I thought, Christianity, well, if you get captured, fine, but nobody really draws another human being toward Christianity from within it. It just must happen to you. But her question was really good. I thought about it. And I started opening the Bible for the first time. And then that made me come to church for a few times. And then I came to that decision point for my own decision. And I made that decision the night before Easter of 86. And I came to Sunrise Service and confirmed it in a congregation of people. But I kind of reached that decision the night before that I was going to get my life to Christ.
Yeah, and so how many years after that did the two of you actually get married? Four more years?
Yeah.
Five more years.
Five more years. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He became a Christian, and then I worried a little bit that he did it for me, not for God.
Right.
And I didn't know how to discern.
Wanted to make sure it was genuine.
And so we ended up, like, breaking up for a while and kind of had our own separate lives, and then we ran into each other and kind of hit up from where it landed. And he had a personal relationship with the Lord that whole time, and I already knew his family. He already knew mine, and his family liked me and mine liked him.
So the families were involved. That's good. Yeah. All right. Well, there's a very good example of a complex, lengthy courtship. Probably a little longer than normal for the rest of us. Mine wasn't that long by any means. So, but yeah, we are out of time. So I'm going to pray and wish you all a happy Mother's Day and treat your mother well today. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the day and age in which we live, where we're learning so much more about how we can manage the planet for the benefit of ourselves and all life. And thank you, Lord, for creating such an amazing planet and putting here at the ideal time. There couldn't be a better time, Lord, for us to put us here on planet Earth. So make us grateful, not only for this wonderful planet that you made for us, but the timing in which you've placed us here. And Lord, I pray this Mother's Day, you make us wonder, appreciate that we're here not just to enjoy life, but to fulfill the purpose for which you created us. Thank you, Lord, that you chose fit among all the instruments in your creation, that we would be the most crucial instruments in bringing about the end of all evil and suffering and pain and death. And we look forward to that time when we can rule with you over the new creation. So, Lord, I pray, help us to give honor to those of us that gave birth to us. In Jesus' name, amen.